Welcome back, everyone. Dr. B here. Thanks for joining us for another episode of Ask the Dentist. Today, we are interviewing a dentist that also is a researcher and that holds a patent in the nano realm of dentistry. And nano is a very hot topic these days, nano hydroxyapatite, obviously, but also nano silver. And I think you'll find the discussion very interesting because it is more than just dentistry. And it's dentistry at a very advanced or very futuristic kind of, with a futuristic point of view. And it holds, or we speak to a lot about what is coming and what's already here, but what you may not be getting from a dentist that is probably a wonderful clinician, but has been out of dental school for a while and has not been exposed to this new tech. And again, many of you follow me on Instagram because you are getting this information, but I think this episode is a doozy. I think you'll find it very interesting. The episode actually went on for over an hour, so we're going to break it down into two different episodes. So part two will appear next week. I highly recommend that you listen to part one because it gives a lot of context from which we talk about actionable items in terms of oral care and oral health, what to look for in a dentist in part two. I think you're going to find Dr. Ryan Nolan very interesting. We talk about all the typical stuff. We talk about dental insurance, the current curriculum in dentistry. We talk about functional, integrative, biological, holistic dentistry. What are the differences? I loved his answer on where he fits on that spectrum. You'll hear it, I think, in the first episode. Sorry, the first part of the episode. We talk about the practice of dentistry and how that conflicts with the goal of dental science. That's pretty much right there, the theme of part one of this episode, and I think you'll find it very interesting. There's a new breed of dentist out there, and it's a dentist, scientist, researcher, kind of a medical dentist, and that's kind of where we're going, and I think you'll see this or hear this in part one of this episode. Of course, we talk about the oral systemic connection, biofilm, oral microbiome, caries, otherwise known as cavities, gum disease, and then obviously we end with oral care products, and I think you're going to hear some things that may surprise you, but also will encourage you, things that perhaps you have not heard from your dentist or your current hygienist. Anyway, so Dr. Ryan Nolan, he graduated from dental school, I think in 2014. He definitely represents the new breed of dentist, which I'm excited about. You've heard me always championing this type of dentistry, kind of the bigger picture type of treatment, systemically, globally, looking at the body as a whole, not just the mouth alone. He's actually chief scientist of a research company in Provo, Utah, and he actually holds a few patents. I think you're going to find that very interesting. It is a very kind of novel way of synthesizing nanosilver, and how he's introduced it into products, I think you'll find very, very fascinating. And we do talk about fluoride. We both have the same opinion of fluoride. We also talk about nanohydroxyapatite. Again, lots of things, lots of subjects that I think you will find very interesting. So without any further ado, here is part one of the episode. Sorry if we nerd out a little bit. You can just kind of like fast forward through those parts. But overall, I think you'll find this very interesting. Enjoy. Hey, everyone. When was the last time you got a good night's sleep? Or when was the last time you knew or was able to verify that you got a good night's sleep? Well, as many of you know, I'm a sleep medicine trained dentist. I have treated thousands of patients for sleep disorder breathing and other sleep issues. I literally track sleep for a living for my patients. So today I'd like to talk to you about something that's just as crucial to your health as good dental hygiene and optimal oral health. It's the quality of your sleep. This is why I'm thrilled to introduce to you 8 Sleep. It's a revolutionary sleep technology that's not only changing the way we think about our beds, our mattresses, but about our sleep. The 8 Sleep Pod is more than just a mattress cover. It is a high-tech sleep system that helps you optimize your sleep by controlling the temperature, the surface temperature of your mattress, tracking your sleep stages, and even waking you up at the optimal time with gentle vibrations. But here's the kicker. The 8 Sleep Pod can adjust the temperature of your mattress throughout the night without you even knowing it. 2 reasons why that's very important to me and to my patients. If you sleep on a foam mattress, as I do, these mattresses tend to, quote unquote, sleep warmer. And 2, and this is crucial, thermoregulation is a key component to achieving deep and therefore restorative sleep. Your body temperature normally dips as it nears deep sleep, and being able to control this parameter of the circadian rhythm is what makes this product indispensable in achieving the best night's sleep possible. I've been using the 8 Sleep Pod myself now for almost a year, and I've noticed a remarkable improvement in my sleep quality, and I'm able to verify it in the morning with the sleep measurements that appear on my iPhone. Better sleep means better mood, better productivity, and yes, better oral health. Ready to take your sleep to the next level? Visit 8 Sleep, that's the 8, and then SLEEP.com, 8sleep.com, to learn more and use the promo code AskTheDentist, all caps, all one word, for a special discount. Trust me, your body and your teeth will thank you. Hi, everyone. Dr. B here again. Thanks for listening and watching. We are talking with a critical thinker today and a dentist. You've heard me say in the past that that's not a very common grouping. I try not to be critical of my profession, but today I think you'll understand what the difference is between a dentist that is up to date on research, that thinks out of the box, that takes all the clinical knowledge that dentist has and also their curriculum and melds that all into one effective protocol for his or her patients. And that's why we're here talking with Dr. Ryan Nolan. We're going to talk more about your background. I want you to help us with that. And where does this podcast find you today? Where are you today?
So I am in Utah.
And you practice in Utah as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Probably Salt Lake, near Salt Lake.
Yep, near Salt Lake.
Beautiful
yep.
area. So tell us a little bit more about yourself. I guess the obvious question is, why did you want to be a dentist? How did you get there?
Gosh, isn't there a lot of answers to that? I've always been interested in the sciences. Obviously, biology, chemistry is my favorite subject. Always will be chemistry, physics. And I originally was pre-law, actually, but I ended up kind of going down the chemistry route and got a degree in chemistry. And then I shadowed some different professions and realized that, hey, you know, I really enjoy working with my hands. I enjoy the medical aspect, but I didn't want to go down the road of just medical either, because I felt like there wasn't a lot of fixes. I felt like it was a lot of management, and I wanted to be able to have people come in and be like, hey, this is not only an art, but I'm actually trying to fix the problem. And then as I got further down the line, I'm like, I don't want to just fix the problem. I want to address the root issues. I want to actually understand what's causing the problem and not just be the fixer. So it's taken kind of like an interesting route. And especially with my background being that it's chemistry, I've been able to kind of apply that to understanding like prevention better.
So would you describe yourself as a holistic, an integrative, a functional dentist? Not to put labels on anything, but...
No, you're fine. Yeah. I don't even know what I am. I am a breed of something.
Right.
I'm a scientist, an academic, a researcher, a teacher, a entrepreneur, I don't know. It's an interesting situation. I don't really know what to call myself. Mm-hmm. But I think if I was going to have a label, it would probably be critical thinker. That's like what I try to do as much as possible. And I think there's elements of each one of those that I feel like represent me, but not entirely as a whole. And I don't know how to categorize it, but I feel
there's no label for that. Yeah. There's no label for that. And it is a small grouping in any profession, whether it's medical or dental, chiropractic. It doesn't really matter if you're a nutritionist. Most of your training is I don't want to use the word dogma, but it's a fixed set of facts and a history of clinical knowledge, and that gets passed on to you. And let's face it, the dental curriculum, let's focus on that, as are many other curriculums, there's very little time to get that knowledge because it is such a complex breadth of knowledge. And not only are you teaching that clinician facts, but you're teaching them how to treat a patient, especially if it's surgery. And that's the problem or the crux with dentistry, the most expensive, costly education in the world, right? Because mm-hmm. you're not only being taught to be a diagnostician, but also a surgeon. I don't think a lot of people realize that dentistry, I mean, you're a dentist typically sits down and does 10, 15, 20 different little microsurgeries, root canals, cavity preps, crown preps, extractions. I mean, I think a lot of people still see it as a very mechanical wood carpentry kind of thing. And even physicians see it that way. And I'd love to talk to you more about how physicians and dentists don't get along that well and should and why. But back to what you were saying about not being able to categorize yourself. I love that. And then basically your last line was, well, you're a critical thinker. Shouldn't every clinician be a critical thinker? Isn't that kind of where it should start?
Yes. I think obviously when you get into the realms of, you know, depending on where you get your dental education, I feel like a lot of what we're being taught is dated. It's also not necessarily a poor approach, but we should be looking and constantly trying to update our knowledge instead of just saying, hey, this is what I learned in dental school, that therefore I stop here.
Right.
You know, as early as 2012, I have been reading about 10 to 15 articles a week. And that adds up over a long period of time.
Yeah.
And so the thing is you have to be constantly scanning the literature and being with the times, shall we say. And that requires kind of a lot of, if you're not interested in that, a lot of motivation, but it's going to make you think differently about procedures that you might have been doing. How mm-hmm. I practice now is not how I practiced 5 years ago. The materials are different, how I treat patients is different. But also, you know, going back to something we've discussed before, is it's not necessarily just the clinical aspect of it. There's the researcher who has all the time, and then there's the clinician who has no time to address an issue. And so sometimes the best thing I could offer 5 years ago might not be the best thing I offer today,
right?
But it's because of keeping up with the science that we have, at least I feel, a better understanding of how to treat patients. And so I think anybody who's passionate about dentistry should obviously continue to learn what's going on. Right.
Right. Yeah. It's, there's the, kind of the time continuum where you come out of dental school, you're a safe beginner, you're just loaded with knowledge, your skill set grows over time, hopefully. And then you start learning as a dentist what works well for you in your practice. And then you kind of get in that rut, and it prevents you from thinking about what new technology, what new, unless you've got salesmen coming in through the door all the time, you're bombarded with all the new technology. But
right.
But with the new research and the new science, I mean, let's take the aging dentist, maybe mid-career, and there are many dentists out there that I'm describing that miss the oral microbiome, the advent or the discussion completely. Or the discovery of the oral microbiome completely. And it's like they're still in that rut. So we were talking about this before I hit the record button. The practice of dentistry often conflicts with the goal of dental science. A lot of that is timing, 15, 20 years until that gets back into the curriculum. But if you're out of the curriculum, maybe through continuing education, you'll get it. But a lot of dentists pick continuing education based on cost, speed, and also just their area of interest. I guess what I'm trying to ask you is, how does a patient, prospective patient, find a dentist that is up to date?
That's a great question. I feel like if I'm a patient, and the one thing that we do at our practice is we try to get to know our patients, first of all. And second of all, we try to ask kind of intriguing questions about not just what's going on, but hey, you know, what's your background? Get a really good medical history, right? And I think the thing is if you're not asking enough questions, how are you supposed to, so you might be addressing fixes, but you're not addressing what maybe the root issue or cause of something is. And I know that word, that those words get a bit abused. I mean, a lot of people are like, well, I know that the root cause is this or whatever.
Right.
The reality is though, is that every individual is unique. And so you have to treat them as, hey, I need to see what's going on. I need to look at your teeth and your mouth and your body as a whole. You know, I have been kind of preaching the systemic connection for a long, long time. And the reality is that a lot of these issues that occur in the mouth are simply a reflection pool of what is occurring elsewhere in the body, right?
Right.
So obviously there's the downwards effect of, hey, your gut is the next place after your, you know, after your oral cavity. But then there's the systemic inflammation component that also affects the oral cavity. So it's kind of like a dominoes situation. And so if you're only addressing the fixes, hey, instead of saying, let's fix your cavity, why did your cavity start in the first place? Right? Like, I think it's a little bit too archaic to just be a surgeon. I think you have to be a surgeon. And I think you also have to be a bit of an academic to think, okay, what are the two pieces of this? Instead of just, hey, you know what? We're just going to fix it. I'm never going to explain to you any potential solutions or any ways that you could mitigate this or any reason why that might have happened. Therefore, you know, the patient kind of stays in the dark about what potential things could be beneficial. I obviously understand the dentist has like less time, but I try not to make that excuse. I try to talk to every patient about potential preventative treatments as well, or prevention, just knowledge in general. And I think they do appreciate it. I think the average patient is actually now hunting for people who are, or looking for people, I should say, voraciously, who have that knowledge. I don't think it's good enough to, you know, be 30 years behind anymore and just stick with your degree and that's good enough. I don't think people like that.
I think in a very simplistic model, patients are getting the information via a podcast like this. I see this happen all the time. I've seen family members get information about things that I don't know about. Maybe it's concussions or something, neurological things, and they're not getting the information from their existing providers. So they seek it out, and then that gives them a kind of a level of knowledge where they know what to look for. And I see that happening in dentistry. People are going in and they're interviewing their dentist, or they observe their dentist, and if they're not getting what they feel they should be getting, like a reason for why this is being done and why it happened, as you were saying. So I think the internet has definitely changed that. And I think the consumer, the patient, has become a lot more sophisticated. Let's talk about the other side of that coin, though. How about the ones that are come in and are demanding certain things and don't listen or don't understand the science or have been exposed to misinformation in that conduit that I just was talking about, the internet and podcasts and Instagram? I mean, what, I'm sure you see that every day, maybe, I don't know. How do you deal with that?
So, you know, I try and do my best to educate the patient. So like a typical exam for me looks like the patient comes in. I usually will sit down, I'll ask them if they have anything going on. If they've had a history, kind of go over that with them. And then I will usually take a lot of intraoral photos. Even if the patient doesn't have a lot going on, I'll talk to them about, hey, you know, what's your symptoms? Do you have anything going on? Has anybody ever talked to you about prevention? What are the things that we can go over? So I think for me, I think the reality is you have to be willing to go over some of these things with a patient in order to get the information. If you're not hunting for the information, then you're kind of in the dark.
Right.
I think misinformation is rampant. And I think that it's easy for somebody to cut a podcast clip that's not even from a podcast to make it look like you're on a podcast.
Right.
You appear as if you're an authority figure.
Right.
Then only to realize that it's people who've never been, you know, to dental school, never got a degree in anything. Not to say that's just the only way of having information,
Right.
But people take it very seriously. So I'll give you an example. Okay. There was a reel going around about maybe 6 months ago, and it's a conspiracy theory that, if the toothpaste at the bottom, like the actual paste, has a red or a black, it's got a bunch of chemicals in it or something like that.
You mean the tube?
Yeah, the color on the end of the tube.
It's like a code.
Yeah. And so they're like, so I had somebody email me and they're like, hey, Elementa, one of the tubes I got has a black little tip there. Right. I saw this reel and, it's got to be made of 80% chemicals. And I'm like, that is not how that works. Okay. So that's something that's interesting because I teach dental hygiene as well. And so one of the things I always tell them is be willing to think critically about the information, who you're getting it from, and is it a reliable source?
Mm-hmm.
What might've been reliable again, also 20 years ago, might not be reliable today.
Right.
Or vice versa, right? It just depends on the quality of what you're getting. I occasionally do have people that really don't want to either get the type of treatment I'm recommending or maybe they don't want a certain thing I'm offering. And after having a conversation, if I feel like they're not a good fit for the office, sometimes dismissal is the answer. Sometimes it's, hey, you know what? Here's some resources. Go read about it.
Right.
Because I want to give you a chance to try and understand this. But I mean, not every patient is a good fit for a doctor and not every doctor is good for a patient. And I feel like the interview process is both ways. So it's not necessarily keeping every patient as the best idea, but vice versa. Like if you feel like your doctor's not addressing things with you or not spending the time to talk to you about a concern that you have, then you should definitely get a second opinion, right? I have no problem with that.
Patient's choice. Yep.
Exactly. I mean, we are not in the situation anymore where a white coat justifies making the decisions alone. It's a joint decision between the patient and the doctor. Yeah. Realistically, it should be at least, right?
You mentioned books and I thought that's a great idea. And I do recommend books on our website. But then I thought there are some books out there and you know what I'm talking about. There's one that is on Amazon. It's a bestseller, I guess. How to Kiss Your Dentist Goodbye.
Oh, I've never read that one.
Oh yeah, you want to read that one.
Okay.
Oh my goodness, the worst advice possible. But anyway, I think that's the title of the book, but it's something to that nature. Oh, so yeah, if you do all this stuff, you never have to see your dentist.
Oh gosh.
I mean, tartar doesn't, doesn't go.
That's so well. Like, again, that's a different form. Like, so it's absolutism, but it's in the opposite direction, right?
Yep.
And so I think that you should have enough trust in your healthcare provider, whoever it is that you choose, mm-hmm. that when you get advice from them, you view it as kind of like your counsel, right? Like, okay, well, I'm getting counseled to do this.
Mm-hmm.
I might want to do some research on that if I'm not aware of what that is or I don't understand it. But to avoid going to a dental professional who has trained all these years, and frankly, I mean, I'm not saying I'm the best by any means, but I have a unique perspective because I do research and I do clinical. And so I always try and make sure patients feel comfortable that like, hey, as of right now, this is the best treatment I can offer. Maybe in 5 years, that might be different, but we can't wait 5 years to do this. Okay. Yeah. So it's good to see different perspectives, but I do feel like people, they want to either, how would I put it? It's like they're looking for attention or they're so self-convinced that their way is the only way. And I also don't believe that. Right. I feel like you can get to the same place with different answers. And I feel like that's also something that people need to accept. Because if you only think there's one solution to something, I feel like that's like a disservice to all the other research that's been done. Not to say they're all equivocal, but sometimes there's approaches that could be different and you might be able to get a better or similar outcome. And I feel like people also need to be open to that as well.
Right. I mean, you always should be seeing the best clinician possible, someone that has great hands and is able to do work properly and safely. But if the clinician is not able to decide what is the right treatment based on their inability to see the big picture or current knowledge, then that wonderful clinician is really, it's a waste of that patient's time.
And it's a surgeon at that point.
Right. Just a pure surgeon. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Totally
agree. Let's get into, let's talk a little bit about dental insurance. I'm always fascinated what dentists feel about that. We don't need to spend a lot of time on it.
All good.
And then we'll get into like the hot topics, you know, oral systemic connection, oral microbiome. We can talk about caries, perio, and then we'll get into products. That's what most, we'll get into the actionable items. I also want to talk about your product. You're a manufacturer. Sure. You're not just a researcher. You've actually put that to use in a product that is for sale. And then we'll talk about different ingredients and we'll take it from there. So let's talk about dental insurance. Obviously it's not really true insurance. I as a young dentist really disliked it at first. And then I kind of got to the point where, well, I realized that it was bringing people in through the front door.
Right.
I would never treatment plan based on insurance, but of course we had to coach them as to how to use the insurance effectively so they don't waste it. And obviously if you refer out to someone, then the deductible goes down, the patient comes back, they don't understand that, not the deductible, but the, you know, what the maximum, sure. All of that. So it's a benefit. It's a very lucrative product for the insurance companies because they know exactly what the utilization is because it has a cap, a very low cap. It certainly does not protect, let's say you get into a car accident or a ski accident, knock out a bunch of teeth, there's no way you're fully covered. So how do you view dental insurance? Is it a good thing for the patient, for the doctor? Is it bad? How does it fit into your mindset?
It's definitely not good. I mean, if you look at it, I want to say they did some research on this and they compared the maximum benefit that you were going to get from like 1970 to today. Mm-hmm. And I want to say it was the same amount, somewhere around $1,500.
Yeah. It didn't take into account inflation. You're right.
Yeah. So it never really took into account inflation. And, you know, to be honest, you know, $1,500 doesn't get you very far at the dentist, mm-hmm. especially if you have like a major need. I think for me, I view it as a coupon. And I try and explain to people that it's really a coupon.
That's a good one.
It's great to get a benefit, but it's not something that you should rely on for your dental health. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things, like I'll give you a common example, like people don't understand when it's like, hey, you know what? You have a high perio risk. You might need 3 or 4 cleanings a year instead of 2. Mm-hmm. And frankly, we're trying to do our best, but you're probably going to have to pay out of pocket for those other cleanings. But the reality is it's that, or you end up with all these other issues, mm-hmm. right? And so you have to kind of explain to them that the dental insurance is really not insurance. It's kind of like what you said, right? Yeah. And not everybody's going to go along with that. And it does bring people in the door, but I feel like less and less it's really an insurance. It's really just a glorified coupon and you know, sets us a rate with a dentist. Yeah. But it shouldn't be the sole reason why you choose your provider, right. Ever.
Yeah. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't have a choice. They go sure. from a list, and that right away tells you that that is a worse product than mm-hmm. being able to choose which provider you want. And a lot of people, I mean, we have a functional dental directory on our website, and we direct a lot of people to like-minded dentists. Sure. But sometimes people will complain, well, you know, it's more expensive. And yeah. But the beauty of having a good dental insurance plan that allows you to see anyone is that that dentist will take that insurance and will help you use it properly. And again, as you said, it is better than nothing. And again,
it's better than nothing for yeah. sure, but it's definitely not something that I would write home about wouldn't think that it's going to cover me if right. I have a real problem going
right.
on.
Right. It's just a benefit. And the fact that the industry, the insurance industry calls it insurance, I think is really
a misnomer. They shouldn't allow to be called insurance.
Yeah. Again, mostly a self-regulated industry and to great effect for themselves. Let's go to the hot topics in dentistry. A lot has changed. I don't know when you graduated from dental school, but even, I know even though it was recent, a lot has changed. In fact, 2014 is right when the oral microbiome was coming online, but I bet you didn't get much of it, a little bit of it, but not much of it in the curriculum because those curriculums are like big battleships. They take a long time to reconfigure and change course. And do you think your school is teaching like sleep apnea, sleep disorder breathing, oral microbiome, oral systemic? We do not a little really. Bit of oral systemic connection.
There was some. I mean, I'm not going to say there was none.
Right.
But not a lot. And right. so, you know, the things that you don't leave with dental school is a really good understanding of preventative science. It's really washed over. Mm-hmm. You don't really understand nutrition that well. Not mm-hmm. to say that I'm an expert at nutrition now, but right. that's not really an important topic. And the oral systemic connection, I feel like at the time was just kind of coming out. Mm-hmm. So there was, we would go over like correlations and stuff between like heart disease and like periodontal bacteria, but it really kind of stopped and started there. I didn't really feel like I got like a massive injection of it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until after I graduated when I was really kind of ramping up on this and started doing more research, specifically on the oral microbiome and its effects right. everywhere else, right? Downstream, right. upstream, whatever. But I would say the traditional curriculum is very slow to adopt new topics, mm-hmm. even if those topics are completely relevant and patients are looking for them. And so when you actually get into clinical practice, it's almost like you're in a different gear switch. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you might get things that you think you know from dental school, and then that material is actually very dated. And so it might not actually be super relevant. You know what I mean?
Right. How has the oral microbiome changed the practice of dentistry? I know it's a loaded question. Just kind of give me your big picture on that.
How's it changed it? Well, I don't think there was great adoption of like testing for it until relatively recently.
Right.
I think that was a general concern of a lot of people was that even though some of the testing existed, there wasn't a drive from the clinician to start doing testing. You know, obviously in our office, we do oral DNA. We do oral DNA testing. It's not the only company. There's Bristol. There's a couple other ones. But the reality is that patients are now at the point where they want more diagnostics and they want more information about their personal health. Mm-hmm. We've seen an explosion in kind of personal health testing from a range of different items, not obviously things that are outside of oral care, but also in oral care. And we're getting more sophisticated data back on what might determine outcomes for patients. Now, you know, I've talked about this before, but the problem wherein lies, right, is the oral microbiome is a very difficult field to navigate because just kind of like the bottom of the ocean, we don't have a lot of information. We have information, but we don't have information at the same time.
Right.
Because it's so complex when you start talking about 700 different species of bacteria interacting together. You know, you have a really complicated mess on your hands to deal with. So it's something that I feel like the science is advancing rapidly, but as we get more information, it's kind of like layers, right? So like your understanding of it is going up, but then you have to kind of zoom out sometimes and be like, oh, like I need to think about this for a second. This hurts my head. Like mm-hmm. there's a lot going on under the hood here, right. You know?
I think AI is going to be the savior in that area. You're right. I mean, we can collect the data. The data is getting to a higher resolution. We're seeing the bottom of the ocean a little bit better with more detail. But then it's all about these relationships, about certain bugs to other bugs. And it's mm-hmm. not just one bug to another. It's all these bugs, over 700 species and how they're interacting. And then there's the individuality of each biome, oral microbiome, from person to person. Then it's the environment. What are they eating? How do you tie all that in? It's like a chess game.
So it's the three body problem times 700, yeah, right?
Exactly. I mean, right.
The 700 layers of complexity. And so like, okay, like, you know, the things that we're seeing as we research the microbiome, the oral microbiome specifically, mm-hmm. is there seems to be pairs of bacteria that have more interaction than other ones. Right. And then what I mean by this is if you even just look at the stacking of how these self-organize, there's patterns of stacking and everybody has a different pattern of stack. Mm-hmm. And so there might be, if we're hypothesizing, there might be 17 or 18 or even 40 or 50 different patterns that are commonly emerging. And those patterns actually determine the interactions between different pairs of bacteria and the overall picture of which bacteria are interacting with the whole. So right. you have the microorganizations, and then you have the macro organization of the biofilm, mm-hmm. and you have those all interacting at the same time. And so the goal of research is to kind of work backwards and to find what find easy ways to test to see maybe what pattern somebody has. And as a result, hey, what is this pattern susceptible to if it's a disease-causing pattern? How do we change it back to a commensal pattern? Or how do we get this you know, this, how do we turn the notch this way without destroying everything?
Right.
Because that's the other thing you'll see is you'll see like, you know, I would say the archaic science is just destroy everything. But a nuclear bomb is not the correct approach to dealing with the oral microbiome. Mm-hmm. And controlling the patterns and of controlling some of the variables are really the only lock and key we have right now. And so that's kind of like the submarine exploring the, you know, the Mariana Trench here. It's like, right, we're really in our infancy trying to understand this stuff, but we have enough of an understanding that we know how to walk a little bit. And so we're trying to understand our surroundings. And I feel like a lot of people are still, you know, not at that point where they are looking at this critically or trying to find relationships. I mean, I think there was a really cool study recently, I think you posted about it, but there's an interesting link between Fusonucleatum bacteria and colon cancer.
Right.
I mean, that's crazy, man. Yeah. Like that's absolutely nuts.
Yeah.
And so we need to understand that it's there's all these effects that we're seeing depending on what gets out of control in the oral microbiome with just general disease paths, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, for me and my family, we're very susceptible to colorectal cancer. Mm-hmm. And so to know that is very beneficial, right?
Yeah.
Especially if my FN is higher. But anyways, point aside is there is so much complexity in the layers of the oral microbiome. I don't think anyone truly knows what a perfect oral microbiome looks like yet.
Haven't seen it.
I wish there was an easy answer to that question.
Yeah.
So what we have to do is we have to look at end states, and we have to look at pH, and we have to look at mineral content, and we have to look at what's harmful and what's not harmful, mm-hmm. and make really educated guesses based on the literature what we have.
Right.
What's going to lead to the best outcome, right?
Right.
And we don't know what horse is going to win at this point because we're halfway through the race. Let's be honest.
The good news is that we're out of the fog.
Yeah.
By blasting and disinfecting and killing everything in the mouth and hoping for a good result and doing that for over a century or more.
It doesn't work. And I mean, look at the, so let's quickly discuss it, right? Because the caries rate hasn't really changed that much.
No.
I know everyone wants to believe, you know, that we've done a really great service by fluoridating the water and that we've done a great job at reducing the caries rate. As a clinical researcher, I question that data completely. I don't think it was the best thing we could have ever done. I think it was a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's going to take a long time for people to come to the table on that because that's a difficult pill to swallow. Mm-hmm. But like the thing that we were talking about earlier before the podcast got going was the Cochrane review that was done in 2015, which compared different countries that used to fluoridate, didn't fluoridate, or have fluoridated but no longer fluoridated, and compare them to fluoridated countries. And they look at something called the DMFT, which is a fancy word for cavity rates, okay, amongst different individuals in the population, and they're identical, okay? Yep. So if you fluoridated or didn't fluoridate, the rate of decay is identical. And so that has to make you go down the critical thinking path of maybe some of these controls in these studies pre-1970s were not that great. Maybe there was other factors. Maybe the data wasn't handled properly. But then, you know, you start looking at risk benefits of some of these things. And, you know, frankly, it's, you really have to ask yourself these questions. You know, in dental school, it's obviously very pro fluoride. And I do still use some forms of fluoride with really high risk patients. So, mm-hmm. You know, fluoride varnish, I really like.
And that's a topical
but
application.
In general,
it's not in the water.
Yeah, but in general, I no longer support water fluoridation.
Right.
Sometimes it surprises people that I say that, but then I'll be like, all right, well, let's have a debate about it and let's have an honest discussion. And it's funny how many people after, you know, getting into the weeds of it are like, oh yeah, you kind of have a point. Like, I didn't really think of it that deeply.
Well, the risk to benefit ratio, that's what you got to look at. I mean, what's easier to fix? A kid's brain that's developed in a way that cannot be reversed, or someone's tooth, that's if in fact fluoride actually worked. I mean, fluoride and water.
We don't know really if it does or not.
Yeah,
I don't think it's very conclusive. And I think like the idea that, you know, fluorine, I guess you could say. So I've dealt with many different forms of fluoride. I was a chemist. Okay. I've handled multiple forms of it. It's very aggressive. It's very electronegative. And so mm-hmm. when you put it into different compounds, it has it's looking for to satisfy its orbital. And as a result, it's going to primarily bind to certain things, calcium, so the skeleton, and obviously certain area, other tissues, and it can cause damage, right? Mm-hmm. Now, you could say, well, hey, if it doesn't reach a threshold amount, but the thing is there, if you're getting exposed to it in your shower, outside, in the pool, drinking water, everywhere you go, you can't get a, you can't get away from it, right? Yep. And so it's one of those things where you have to ask yourself too. So let me just put it to you. Let's just do another hypothetical, right? Let's say that I knew that 20% of the population after the age of 60 is going to develop osteoporosis. I don't know this. I'm just making something up. Okay. And I realized that if I put calcium in the water, that I could get half of those patients to not be osteoporotic or reduce the risk by 50% or something like that. It would still not really make a lot of sense, because if I did that, I might be harming other individuals as a result of they didn't need it, or it was excessive, or it harmed their kidneys or whatever. Right. And I feel like that's kind of a common sense argument for why you wouldn't just stick any old thing in the water as a supplement. But fluoride seems to have gotten a pass time and time and time again. Yep. And I feel like no one wants to critically reevaluate. And luckily there is a lawsuit going on. And, you know, I know you talk about it a lot. We've talked about it, but it's one of those things where I think even the traditional dentist still hasn't really come to terms with this. Right. And it's going to come as a surprise. Right. And that, and you know, it was very easy like 10, 15 years ago to be like, oh, maybe this person is a little kooky or whatever. But now it's like, well, the data is kind of indicating that there's IQ issues. There's potential for carcinogenic issues. There's, you know, teratogenic issues. There's all kinds of potential issues, and we have other alternatives, you know? And so it's not something where like, that's the only thing available anymore. And, you know, I kind of call it the amalgam of preventative dentistry, you know? And so it's not something that I'm like trying anymore. And it does have topical application, but it's just one of those things where like, I feel like the discussion needs to start happening. Like, hey, is this really the best that we can do? And if it is the best that we can do, why?
Yeah, we're waiting for the verdict. It's seems to be a little overdue, but it's a very complicated subject, and it's one judge that's deciding, and ironically, he knows more about fluoride than I would say 99% of the dentists out there.
So yeah, sad.
Dr. Judge Chen. So take your time. Well, as you said when we started this conversation about fluoride, I mean, this if you look at, for example, like Europe, non-fluoridated, the EU at least, non-fluoridated, you compare a non-fluoridated community to a fluoridated community, there's really not much difference between, if any at all, between the effect or the supposed effect of fluoride and it supposedly reducing the incidence of caries. And so obviously there are other things going on, but dentistry really doesn't want to address that. You know, big food doesn't want us to address it, of course, because it is a food issue, environment issue, diet issue. You know, there are other things too. There's airway, there's mouth breathing, there's the pH. What we're going to go into next are the oral products. Oral products are making things worse. Again, that's another big entity and corporate entity that is just fine with what they're making and doing right now and making billions of dollars from it. So this is kind of what we talked about earlier in this discussion about all the misinformation out there. This is on the macro level. This misinformation is actually affecting your provider, your dentist, the person who's giving you advice. So hopefully, and that's the intent of our platform, Ask the Dentist, is to inform people and tell them, you know what, you've been misled. Your provider may have been misled. You need to know what is going on. And so, and that's why I keep coming back to this. Find a dentist that's a researcher. I mean, it's kind of like, why wouldn't you want that? It's because that person will be a critical thinker. Again, that's how we started this conversation. Thanks for listening to Ask the Dentist. This is a Resonant Media production produced by Drake Peterson and mixed by Mike Fry. Drop me a line at mark@askthedentist.com. If you have any comments or suggestions, I'd love to hear them. And if you liked this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast app. Thanks for listening and especially for taking an interest in oral health.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Just a reminder that this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not a substitute for professional care by a dentist, doctor, or other qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional dental care provider, you can visit askthedentist.com/directory and search or find a dentist database. It's important that you have someone in your corner who's trained, is a licensed healthcare practitioner, and can help you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.